Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Coramdale Church and Pastor Chris Himmelman of First City Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about the lost generation.
Happy New Year, listeners. I know last week we had an archive episode, so we should just acknowledge it's 2026. Welcome to the fray. We're in our 12th year of this podcast. Yeah.
And people have commented, and I've noticed this, that 2016 was that episode, the last episode that dropped. My voice has changed significantly.
Yeah,
and I just, for the record, want you to know I have not started smoking or anything crazy.
It's just life has beaten it out of you.
Life
is
becoming an old man.
Life has made you.
Experience makes your voice.
That's right. Gravelly.
Deeper.
Hey.
More substance.
Little snack shout out. We got a Christmas gift at the Wednesday Conversation from the Jarvis family out in Utah. Sent us a nice card saying, hey, thanks for the Wednesday Conversation. These are people who attended Coramdale from 2010 to 2014. That was before the Wednesday Conversation even existed. And the Jarvis family sent us some homemade, do you say caramels or caramels?
Depends on where you're from, I think. But they're delicious.
I need you to know this. These are the best caramel. These are the best homemade caramels I've tasted. People do this. It's not the first homemade caramel I've had, but these ones are really good.
Very good. Very good.
Melt. So shout out to the Jarvis family. Thanks for listening to the Wednesday Conversation all the way from Park City, Utah. We're thankful to hear from you. And Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to you. Thanks for the Christmas card. And thanks for the snacks. I did share them with the staff team because they came kind of right around the holidays and some people were out on vacation and we weren't going to be recording for a week or so. So I was like, you know what?
That's me. I was out and this is my first ever Jarvis family caramel.
Did you like it?
Yeah. It was delicious.
You were worried it was going to stick to your teeth and ruin your life.
Yeah, but I loved it instead. It was great.
Yeah. We said, no, they're too good to do that.
On this episode, we are going to talk about an article that burned down the internet right before Christmas. The piece was written on December 15th in Compact Magazine by Jacob Savage. The title of the piece is The Lost Generation, which is why we're titling the podcast with that same title. Here's why it burned down the internet. I saw, and when I say burned down the internet, I just mean I saw so many people sharing this article who do not share a paradigm or a perspective on things. Like I follow a lot of very eclectic people on Twitter/X. And so many people were sharing this article and saying, hey, this guy's talking about something that nobody has said yet, but that is a major story in culture. And so I read it. And then the next day, someone else in our church sent it to me and said, hey, this has been my personal experience. I'd love to hear you guys talk about this on the podcast. So let me quickly set up the thesis the author is laying out in the article. And then I'm going to read a few sections from it. And then we'll just talk about it. I'll read you what this listener sent me of his own personal experience. The thesis of the article is this. White millennial men have gotten the short end of the deal in the last 15 years, vocationally speaking. What this author, Jacob Savage, is doing is saying, hey, all the DEI stuff that started around 2014-15, all the woke stuff that kind of overwhelmed our culture for the last 10 years, all the emphasis on diversity and equity and inclusion, the people that actually really hurt are white millennial males, and no one's talking about it. So can I talk about it? And it's a well-researched, it's a long-form article, and he has a bunch of stats and data and interviewed a bunch of people for this article. And what's interesting is I think he's finally saying something publicly that a lot of people have felt privately. In fact, this listener who reached out to me said, hey, this guy's finally saying something that I've been in this room having this conversation and we couldn't acknowledge it. I'm going to actually start with the listener email because it will help the rest of you listeners understand the perspective of where this person is coming from and where this article is coming from. So this listener wrote me and says, I'm a white male millennial in professional America, and I have seen the story this author is writing about play out in the most jarring example. I attended a lunch where three white men, including me, interviewed another white man for a job opportunity that had been open for a few months. We had passed on other candidates on their work-related merits. This guy was a perfect fit for the role. He was easily the most qualified candidate we had seen, and everybody knew it. We shook hands and said we'd get back to him, and he must have thought he had landed the job. After he left, one of the other interviewers sighed, shrugged, and said point blank, "We need another white guy like we need a hole in the head." And that was the end of the matter. We hired a less qualified person who is still there. That story is what this article is about. What it's saying is what happened from 2014 to 2024 is that a lot of young white millennials who had done all the things you're supposed to do, gotten the degrees and been excellent in their work and gotten to the place where now they're ready to get the big job, were passed over not because they lacked qualification, but because they were young white men. And the interesting thing in this article is that the author says this is not an article about white men. This is an article about white male millennials in professional America, which I think is interesting because he's saying, hey, it's not about being a white guy. It's about a specific subset. It's about people who are millennials, white males, this particular generational experience. We're the ones who took the brunt of the cost of DEI. And that's why he titles the article, "The Lost Generation." Let me read. Here's how it starts. I'll read a few sections from the article now, just so you can get inside the author's thesis a little bit, and then we'll talk about it more. "For 15 years, I've scalped tickets to pay the bills, but in January 2016, I almost managed a real career. I was 31. I'd been in Los Angeles for 5 years writing scripts. There had been minor successes. I'd recently started writing with my best friend. Success felt close. We'd written a pilot script that a veteran showrunner had agreed in a very theoretical Hollywood sort of way to come on to." And so he goes on to talk about, hey, we were on the cusp of having our screenplay or our script for this show embraced. And then he says, "We met with an executive who told us how much he loved our pilot, but the writer's room was small," he explained, "and the higher level writers were all white men. They couldn't have an all-white male room. Maybe if the show got another season, they'd be able to bring us on." So that's his personal experience of getting to a place where he was about to experience this professional breakthrough, and then basically they told him, hey, since you're a white guy, we don't need you. And what he does now is lay down a bunch of stats that reveal how widespread this experience is. In 2011, he writes, "The year I moved to Los Angeles, white men were 48% of lower-level TV writers. By 2024, they accounted for just 11.9%. The Atlantic's editorial staff went from 53% male and 89% white in 2013 to 36% male and 66% white in 2024. White men fell from 39% of tenure-track positions in the humanities at Harvard in 2014 to 18% in 2023. And so he goes on to say, there's a tendency to portray DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, as a series of well-meaning but ineffectual HR modules. You know, there's sort of this narrative like, okay, DEI, maybe it wasn't great, but it was a good, you know, it was an attempt to do something that was important and there was flaws in it. But sort of the broad cultural narrative says it was just maybe not a perfect HR experiment. But this author says, for white male millennials, DEI wasn't a gentle rebalancing. It was a profound shift in how power and prestige were distributed. Yet practically none of the thousands of articles and think pieces about diversity have considered the issue in this way. If you were 40 in 2014, born in 1974, beginning your career in the late 90s, you were already established. If you were 30 in 2014, you hit the wall. So his point is there's an older cohort of white males who had already succeeded and who kind of they were fine. But if you were 30 in 2014 and you were trying to take the next step in your professional career, you were bumping up against this wall suddenly of all the opportunities being closed. And now he knows he's making a provocative thesis here. He knows, hey, you know, you're probably not just going to take my word for it. And so he surveys three different segments of society where the same story is playing out. The first is in journalism. And so he says, let me tell you some stories of some people I interviewed. He talks about this guy, Andrew, who got a job in journalism at a prominent organization in 2015. And 5 years later, he's still in the same role and can't seem to move up. And he's trying to, you know, make it to the next level in his career. And what he keeps hearing is there's enough white guys already. We have enough white guys already. It's now about diversity metrics. And the author, as he's telling the story of this young person, writes this: the truth is, after years of concerted efforts, most news outlets had already reached and quietly surpassed gender parity. By 2019, the newsrooms of ProPublica, The Washington Post, and The New York Times were majority female, as were new media upstarts Vice, Vox, BuzzFeed, and The Huffington Post. Desperate for advancement, he'd had the same job, the same title for nearly 6 years. Andrew looked elsewhere. I applied for positions at The Atlantic, Politico, CNN, The Washington Post, and three different desks at The New York Times. But newsrooms were contracting, and everybody kept telling me it was a race and gender problem. Since 2020, nearly two-thirds of The Atlantic's hires have been women, along with nearly 50% people of color. The Atlantic in 2024 announced that three-quarters of editorial hires in the past year had been women and 69% people of color. Now, the author wants to point out he has no problem with women and people of color getting these jobs if they're qualified. The point is not, he's not mad about who got the jobs. What he wants to point out is that a lot of well-qualified young white men were just simply passed over. They didn't have a shot at getting the jobs. And so the first story he tells is about journalism, and he tracks this guy, Andrew, and he finally, the way the story resolves is this. He was finally recruited for a senior reporter position at a more prestigious outlet, jumping through hoops every step of the way, he told me. But by the end, it felt like a cruel joke. Extensive interviews, writing tests, endless meetings with various editors, only to find out months later the job had gone to someone a decade younger than him, a gay man of color, who'd managed to go from intern to assistant editor to senior reporter in less than 2 years. And Andrew concludes by saying, you can't help feeling like no matter how good you were just born in the wrong year. So he tells a story of journalism, gives some stats there. The second story he tells is about academia. And he quotes this David Austin Walsh, who's a Yale postdoc, who he says, this guy decided to detonate any chance he had at a career with a single tweet. I'm going to read you the tweet. The tweet from David Austin Walsh is, I'm 35 years old, I'm 4 years post-PhD, and quite frankly, I'm also a white dude. Combine those factors together, and I'm, for all intents and purposes, unemployable as a 20th century American historian. And he says, this guy put that out on Twitter, and he got, you know, raked over the coals. Everybody's like, oh, come on, you're just complaining. White guys have plenty of opportunity. It's finally time for some women and minorities to, you know, get these roles. And so he got taken to task on Twitter. But then the author walks through the stats. In Harvard, for tenure track positions, white men have gone from 49% in 2014 to 27% in 2024. Since 2018, only 14% of tenure track assistant professors hired at Yale have been white American men. Among new PhDs, white temporary visa holders, so immigrants, are nearly twice as likely as white U.S. citizens or permanent residents to secure tenure track positions. After giving those stats, he tracks another figure, Ethan, who is trying to get a job as a professor. And so he's trying to come into academia. He says in his first year on the academic job market, Ethan applied to nearly 50 jobs. He was thrilled when he was a finalist for a tenure track position at Brown University. He was flown out to Providence, where he toured the campus and met with faculty. But Brown, like much of the academic world, had other institutional priorities. Ethan made it to the final interview round. After a long back and forth with the search committee, he lost out. Since 2022, Brown has hired 45 tenure track professors in the humanities and social sciences. Just three were white American men. Over the next 3 years, Ethan applied to dozens more positions. He was a finalist for a tenure track position five times. He was flown out again and again for interviews and was always the bridesmaid, never the bride. And it concludes with him saying, "I don't feel like my career path is leading anywhere. It feels like a dead end. There's a huge group of talented white men who can't get tenure track jobs." So, journalism, academia, then he brings the focus back to Hollywood and follows another screenwriter who had a similar experience to his, where he was on track to land a job as a TV writer and consistently did not get it. Here are the stats for Hollywood. In 2011, white men were around 60% of TV writers. By 2025, just 11.9%. White men directed 69% of TV episodes in 2014, just 34% by 2021. Since 2021, 11 directors under 40 have been nominated for Emmys. None have been white men. Now, as you hear all these stats, you might be thinking, okay, well, cool. You know, maybe this is just the rebalancing that's needed. Maybe white guys had too much opportunity, and so now other people are getting opportunity. And so what's the big deal here? And he's arguing, well, part of the big deal is that we have been telling people the wrong story. We've been telling people, hey, if you're good at what you do, there will be opportunity for you. And he says, I just wish I hadn't believed that story. It wouldn't hurt as much if I hadn't believed that if I was just good at what I do and keep my head down and keep working hard, that there would be opportunity for me. So here's how he concludes the article. The DEI departments have mostly shut down or quietly rebranded. The mountains of reports and glossy PDFs have been quietly scrubbed as if to hide the evidence. What was the justification for gutting the American meritocracy? No one seems to know. Which raises some uncomfortable questions. Is the media more trusted now than a decade ago? Is Hollywood making better films and television? Is academia more respected? Have these institutions become stronger since they systematically excluded an entire cohort? Or did abandoning meritocracy accelerate their decline? The fact that other groups in other eras have faced worse discrimination is not itself an argument, especially when the entire liberal establishment insists that nothing actually happened, that the mild correction was in fact no correction at all, and that any white man harmed in the process must have been mediocre. Because what they're really saying is, we weren't supposed to notice. I'm not angry at the women and people of color who made it instead of me. People have the right, in most cases, the responsibility to take the opportunities that are offered to them. Mostly, I'm annoyed at myself. Because instead of settling down, proposing to my girlfriend, and earning a steady income that might support a family, I spent a decade insisting the world treat me fairly, when the world was loudly telling me it had no intention of doing so. The truth is, I'm not some extraordinary talent who was passed over. I'm an ordinary talent, and in ordinary times, that would have been enough. What do I say when my boys ask about my old hopes and dreams? What do I tell them when they ask about theirs? That's how the article ends, which is a pretty powerful ending. And again, I don't know that the author is trying to solve a problem as much as just to raise our awareness of what's actually happened to a lot of young, hardworking white millennials in the past 10 years. And that there actually are consequences to the DEI push that happened in that 10-year period in our culture. And the consequences are, we're not getting better movies, better journalism. It's not like the quality of everything increased. We just excluded a bunch of possibly qualified people from having the opportunity to contribute. And I like how he basically takes responsibility at the end and says, hey, you know, I'm not mad. I'm not extraordinary. I'm an ordinary talent. And in ordinary times, that would be enough. So That's the article, guys. Sorry that it took me this long to summarize it. As you hear it, as you interact with it, what stands out?
The article reminded me of talking to my son, who, when he was first a freshman at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, mentioned a few of these things kind of at the education level that I was very just unaware of. I was just like, oh, this is interesting. Tell me more. And I remember you know, talking about your older son, Bob, who's older than my son and then your other son, and talking about getting his degree and wrapping things up and just kind of needing to, you know,
play the game a little bit.
Yeah, you got to play the game. And I was just like, you know, even according to the stats in the article and the age breakdowns in this article, realizing I'm on the older cusp of this and a little bit unaware when it comes to this experience. But in talking with my kid, I was like, huh, this is an interesting time.
Yeah, the old sort of, hey, work hard, pay your dues, you know, work your way up, kind of that advice, that good advice of really how to build a career when this is a reality and that advice just runs into a brick wall. What do you say? Like, what do you say? Like the way he ended that article was, I think, is very haunting because you're trying to instill a character development in young men with, I mean, nothing's guaranteed, right? Nothing's guaranteed. But at the same time, you are trying to instill in them that, hey, there is a payoff to hard work and working your way up and being humble and being hungry, those kinds of things. But if the system is designed to not reward that kind of thing, that is also a recipe for some alienation among a generation that is really scary. And you're starting to see that. I think that's one of the things why this article resonates so much is there is this deep alienation within this generation and younger that I think largely our culture just wants to shrug and ignore.
Yes. And that's, you know, he mentioned that, you know, people want to just sort of pretend that, like, hey, DEI was just a failed experiment. It wasn't, you know, it was an imperfect policy. And he wants to argue, no, it was more than that. It was an abandoning of meritocracy. Because meritocracy is the most qualified person gets the job. Doesn't matter if they're white, black, man, woman, whatever. Just the most qualified person gets the job. And DEI explicitly said, you know, it's in this story I read at the very beginning of the podcast from the listener who said, you know, we all knew this guy was qualified, but at the end of the day, he's another white guy, so we can't hire him. So we hire somebody less qualified. And that does have consequences both for the excellence of an institution, but also for, yeah, what are you saying to the younger generations coming up? You're basically saying, hey, if you're the wrong gender or race or the wrong subcategory, doesn't matter how hard you work, there's not going to be the opportunity for you. What I think is interesting, or what I want us to think about, is how does the gospel speak to this? So this is a factual experience that many listeners who are young white millennial men may have had. Like, you might have been the guy who went to the job interview, thought you did a great job, and then got the phone call that said, hey, we're going to hire someone else. And if that happened, what does the gospel have to say to you? And then more broadly, how does the gospel speak to meritocracy or to the importance of actually inhabiting and building a system where people really do succeed on the merits of their work, their diligence, and their dedication? To say it another way, we want to live in a world where the book of Proverbs applies, right? Where the things that Proverbs say, hey, as you are diligent, right? The hand of the diligent makes rich, Proverbs says. So we want to live in a world where diligence and faithfulness and dedication to a task and being good at something leads to your ability to do that thing and make a living doing it. Let's think then about how the gospel speaks to what this article is raising and representing. I think one thing to acknowledge is that what the gospel should give all of us in our vocation is an identity that's not tied to our success and our opportunities, right? So the fact is, we actually live in a world where unfair things are going to happen. That's a given. In this case, they have been happening over the past few years to white millennial men. In the past, maybe they were happening to women or to minorities. We live in a world where you face the potential of unjustly missing out on opportunity because of who you are or where you fit in a cultural strata. Part of what the gospel should give us and anchor us in is a sense of identity that can embrace that kind of injustice, not being okay with it, but they can say, it doesn't crush me. It doesn't make me question who I am and what my value is in the world. I can still have a sense of purpose and identity and dedication to my labor, even in spite of the fact that I'm being unjustly treated. And I'm the biblical example that's coming to mind here is Joseph, right? Who's diligent, faithful in Potiphar's house. He's unjustly accused of something, and suddenly all his opportunity is taken away and he finds himself in prison. And what you find is he just continues to be a faithful, virtuous person. He continues to be who he is. And over time, the way that story concludes shows that, hey, God honored his faithfulness and favor. So I think one of the things the gospel lets us do is to say, man, when we face injustice, when we face unfair situations, there's a steadiness and a stability and a groundedness that we ought to have in light of the gospel. That doesn't make those things okay. It doesn't mean we wouldn't want to push back against them or raise them to the surface, but it allows us to not be crushed by vocational disappointment.
Yeah, dealing with injustice is one of the hardest things you're going to have to face. I mean, it is, because you can feel so powerless, so helpless. Like, what do I do? And then it can also, yeah, cut to the core of your identity. And then when you're also talking about your job, you know, a livelihood, there is particular pains to this that you don't want to minimize. And I think that's the starting place for pastors or for leaders or for just, you know, people. If you're in the sharing life with somebody that's facing this, is minimizing it or trying to say, well, these other people over here had that same experience as well. I think that's helpful. I mean, you've got to acknowledge the pain here and the reality of this. But I think for the person experiencing this, the hardest thing, and you highlighted this, Bob, is not letting this define you, not allowing the resentment that in many ways our culture wants to feed to start to take root, and that bitterness to start to take root, and let that define you. Because I think that's one of the scary things, is we have a whole generation of men, and we have, you know, even down past millennial into Gen Z, where you have these young white men who, there's a growing resentment in the culture because of multiple things, the ways that they've been undermined and attacked and minimized. And that's scary, of just the effect that can have. And so for somebody who is a believer in Christ, someone who's rooted and grounded in the gospel, not letting that resentment that could swallow you whole, letting that happen. Because I think the question I would ask is, what is that getting you? I mean, it might feel cathartic in some ways, but is that actually productive? Is it making you a more godly, faithful person? Is that going to propel you forward into something good and healthy? So wanting to help them process the pain, really, but also work hard to not let that root of bitterness, if we're kind of anchoring this in the ways that the enemy would really want to use this to destroy them.
The other way the gospel applies, I think, is that the gospel redeems meritocracy. And what I mean by that is meritocracy, rightly understood, is a good thing. It's a biblical thing. It's the book of Proverbs fleshed out in the world, right? That diligence makes rich, that hard work pays off, that being good at something. Proverbs says a man who's skilled in his work will sit before kings. There is this sense that Proverbs tees us up to expect that in God's good world, excellent work does matter. And the beautiful thing that lets us do that is to say, hey, even when our excellent work isn't recognized, isn't noticed, we don't get the strokes we should or the opportunities we should, the excellence itself is still a beautiful thing. Like, God sees the excellent work you do, even if it doesn't get you the opportunity that you thought it was going to get you. And I think there's a beautifulness to that allows us to treasure excellence for the sake of worship rather than excellence for the sake of personal advancement or satisfaction of my vocational goals. And so the gospel redeems meritocracy in the sense that it tells us we ought to honor the best work and give people the right kinds of honor for the work they do, but also that it helps us not put our identity in that. I think we'll leave the podcast there. The value of this article, and the reason I saw so many people sharing it, is because I think it said the thing that a lot of people were thinking, but no one felt like they could say. And even the author says, I interviewed all these guys for this article. None of them wanted me to use their name. They all wanted to see the article before it went to print because they're all nervous about, I don't want to be associated with the white guy who's complaining about not getting the opportunity. So one of the things I appreciate is just, you know, we should honor truth wherever we find it. And sometimes when someone writes a piece that's like, hey, this is finally saying something publicly that a lot of people have felt privately, but haven't felt like they could say. That's an important moment in our culture. And I think that's why a lot of people resonated with this article. Both it was widely shared and widely agreed with, and I saw some disagreement with it. But what it brought to the surface was a real experience that has been true over the past 10 years that it felt like it's culturally inappropriate to talk about. And so we wanted to at least make it a topic here because one, we're not afraid to talk about those kinds of challenging topics, but two, because a listener brought it forward and said, hey, did you guys read this? I'd like to hear you talk about it. So thanks to that listener for suggesting it as a topic. And again, if there are angles you want to take on this, or if you perhaps have personal experience with this challenge, we'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear who out there has seen this happen in their vocation and how you sort of sought to live through it or embrace it in light of God's grace. So thanks for engaging this topic with us today.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thank you for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners, so if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cbomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.